Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's interview is from our Take Note archives. We talked with Mia Bloom in June 2012. At the time, she was an associate professor in international and women's studies and a fellow at the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State. She's now a professor of security studies at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. Bloom is a leading expert on suicide terrorism and a frequent consultant to the military, policymakers, and the media. She's the author of Dying to Kill, one of the pioneering works in the field. Her most recent book, Bombshell, Women and Terror, provides new insights on female terrorists. We talked with her about who becomes a terrorist and why, about her interviews with failed bombers, and about what the U.S. should be doing to combat terrorism. For the last 20 years, a decade before 9/11, you have been, quote, obsessed with terrorism. What causes it, how it's carried out, who becomes a terrorist, and why. How did you get involved in this field of study?
Many years ago, I was at Georgetown University getting a degree in Arab studies. And I had the pleasure of working with a professor. His name was Ehud Sprintzak, and he was a terrorism expert. And I was his teaching assistant and research assistant. And so about 1989, 1990, we started a series of research projects, one of which became his book on Israeli and Jewish terrorism, which, again, is not something we ordinarily talk about. So the courses we taught at Georgetown University on terrorism, only about half full, a lot of military people, and then people from different parts of the university. But it was very interesting seeing the change in people's interest in terrorism after 9/11.
Now, you actually wrote in 2005, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. It's considered to be one of the seminal books in the field. Before we talk about that, I want to find out a little bit more about you, because I thought it was interesting to learn that one of the influences certainly was your father, who came to Canada in the 1940s with 50 cents in his pocket. Your mother didn't finish high school. You went on to university, learned 8 languages or more, have sat at the table advising the military on terrorism. And I'm just wondering what influence your father had on your decision and the difference you hope to make.
So my father during the war was a member of the partisan unit.
In Poland.
In Poland. And what he was able to do was they broke into one of the ghettos in Łódź and saved about 50 families. They got them out and they put them actually in Azerbaijan for safekeeping, where they survived the war and their families and their families' families. And so my father gave me some pretty big shoes to fill. So when he came to Canada, it was after a series of what could only be described as amazing exploits. And so I grew up knowing that my dad was a war hero and was a hero who had saved at least 100 different people. And now, after they had kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, probably, you know, a few thousand at this point, it was just really a heavy burden in some ways to think, well, I'm not just going to sit on those laurels and do nothing. I wanted to do something with my life.
And my guess is that you are one of the very few women doing the kind of work that you're doing.
Actually, interestingly enough, there are a number of very well-known women who were trailblazing before me, people like Martha Crenshaw, Jessica Stern. So these were women who were interested in terrorism and did interviews with terrorists even before I did. And so they really had an influence. One of the things that I found was, as a woman, it was almost easier to get the interviews with terrorists because they didn't take women seriously. So they thought, oh, sure, we'll talk to the girl. And they would let their guard down and they would be maybe a little bit more candid. They certainly never saw me as a threat. And so some of the best research that's been done in terms of interviewing terrorists has actually been done by women.
And probably more interesting is the fact that women are increasingly involved in real roles and in real ways in terrorism.
Absolutely. You know, although women have been involved in terrorism from the very beginning, the very first person ever tried for terrorism, I mentioned in the book, was Vera Sizulich, and she was a member of the Russian anarchists called Narodnaya Volya. And in 1888, she was on trial for trying to kill one of the leading figures in the Tsarist regime. And at her trial, she was found not guilty, but she proclaimed, you know, I'm not a murderer, I'm a terrorist. She's very proud about that. And so the women have been involved in all these different roles, but it's only recently that we've started to pay attention, in part because we've seen women as suicide bombers, and we've seen this proliferation of women, not just in support roles behind the scenes, but on the front lines, with guns, fighting, routing militaries in Sri Lanka, blowing up American soldiers in Iraq.
Well, what I wonder about Vera, the first person to be tried for terrorism, is I wonder if the fact that she was a woman and that women are more demonized for their role in terrorism is part of the reason that she was the first one tried.
Well, there were a number of women, along with Vera Sisulich and the anarchists, Vera Finger and others, two were involved in the assassination of the Tsar. So women were involved in this particular organization in a significant way, as much as 30%. And part of what the anarchists were saying at the time was, we're not just interested in overthrowing the Tsar, we want equality for women. And so whether it was groups like that or in the 1960s and 70s, groups in Europe, sometimes the terrorist organizations included gender equality as part of their platform. And this, of course, would attract a lot of women in their societies.
Tell us a little bit about human bombs and why certain people are willing to die to kill others.
You know, we were recently at a conference, the American Psychiatric Conference in Philadelphia, and a psychiatrist stood up and said, you know, I find it really disturbing that you speak about terrorists and suicide bombers as if they're normal people. And the response is that, you know, for every measure that a psychiatrist would give an individual, these are not crazy people. These are what I would consider, in many of the conflicts that I've observed, places that I've visited, people I've interviewed, these are regular people in extraordinary circumstances. And found in these extraordinary circumstances, they actually think that by becoming human bombs, they're doing something good for their people or doing something good for their community. They're not seeing it as being human bombs killing the other side. They're seeing it more from the, what am I doing for my people to help them?
Well, in fact, there are some who argue that the term suicide bomber is a misleading term, and that the people, especially the women involved in suicide bombing, are very invested in life.
You know, it's really complicated because we don't have a really good gauge of the one factor that can explain suicide bombing. At least from an Islamic perspective, when you're looking at an individual who decides to volunteer to be a suicide bomber, if that person is depressed and wants to die, they're ruled out automatically as not being eligible or appropriate to be a martyr. Because, you know, in the same way that when you read the Old Testament and they talk about giving sacrifices in Jerusalem, you didn't choose the calf that was lame or about to die. You had to choose the fatted calf, which was the best of your herd. And the same idea goes with this martyrdom, that an individual who is psychologically damaged or somebody who wants to die isn't really a good sacrifice. But more importantly, in the other groups, somebody who's crazy or unbalanced isn't going to be able to perform under pressure. They're not going to be able to keep the secrecy of the organization. So groups don't want crazy people.
And in fact, you say that they want the most attractive women to do this because it increases the amount of press that the incident, that the massacre, will engender.
Absolutely. You know, all things being equal, and this is not to say that every female bomber is attractive. When you look at a list of the bombers with their photos, you are struck by how attractive many of them are. And so, although because of the regulations regarding ethical interviews and the IRB here at Penn State, I can't go into a jail and ask a leading member of Hamas or Islamic Jihad, is this on purpose? But I did have someone else ask. And he approached one of the leading members of Hamas and he said, do you choose attractive women on purpose? And they said, absolutely. All things being equal, if we have five women from whom to choose, we're going to choose the prettier one because not only will it get more press and public attention, but people will look and go, gosh, she's so attractive, so pretty. She had so much to live for. In the same way that they select people with university degrees, they select people that can speak foreign languages because they assume that they're going to be more successful bombers. They don't want these missions to fail.
And so the assumption that most suicide bombers are psychologically disturbed, poorly educated males is wrong. That's out the window these days?
It's out the window. There will be some instances, perhaps in Afghanistan, where we see a lot of uneducated male suicide bombers. But for the most part, all things being equal, if you have a huge population from which to draw potential bombers, the organizational leaders tend to choose people with skills, and they are actually seeking certain skills. They go to the university and they recruit there in the chemistry departments, or they'll look for certain qualities. This person looks really, you know, they've got blonde hair and blue eyes. This would be an ideal person to put on a plane or send to Europe. Or the other thing they're looking at are converts, because they are Western looking, because they're Western originally. And that's why we've seen, again, among the women, female converts to the Islamic faith being used as suicide bombers in places like Iraq.
Well, let's talk about some of the jihadists here at home, Jihad Jane or Jihad Jamie.
So there's a very good example of a woman who was a convert who looks very Western, you know, green eyes, blonde hair. And she's an ideal person to be a role model for other Western women, both Muslim converts as well as non-converts, just regular individuals. And she became involved through social media. She began to post videos to YouTube. Her videos were seen by jihadis, and that's when they reached out to her. And she was eventually caught and found guilty for trying to plot the death of a cartoonist who had portrayed Muhammad in a negative light. And again, it was a really complicated story because she's caught in Pennsylvania for an action that was going to take place against a Swedish cartoonist in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland. So very complicated when you start looking at all the locations. All of this was done through the internet. Women have played this really important role on the internet, not only because you can be anywhere at any time, you don't have to be in a training camp, but they've used gender to their benefit by, you know, women saying, well, if you are a real man, you'd step up.
And goading other men to become active.
They absolutely goad men. And so they throw down the gauntlet and say, you need to go to Iraq and Afghanistan to protect your sisters in Islam from being sexually attacked. When in fact, at least in some of the cases I talked about in the book, it's the Islamic groups that are raping the women in the first place. Ansar al-Sunna has targeted over 80 women to turn them into bombers deliberately. And then on the propaganda, they say, oh, these Iraqi women are being raped. You have to step up and become a jihadi.
They're raped because now their choices are very limited. They have shamed their families. Their opportunities for marriage are null. And so what choices do they have?
Exactly. You know, these groups understand very well the honor code in the society, which means that any kind of behavior, even the slightest inappropriate behavior, is seen in very extreme ways. And so once a woman is raped, pretty much she's brought shame on her family, unless there's three male witnesses to the rape. And that's fairly unusual, unless the men are participants. And so as a result, members of the woman's own family would be expected to kill her to get rid of the shame. The groups have taken advantage of this. And so what they've said is, well, you know, you're going to die anyway. Why not join us and take a few of the other side with you at that moment that you die?
In terms of combating terrorism, how much more difficult is it to combat religiously motivated rather than nationalistic or secular terrorism?
Combating terrorism is generally difficult all around. The religious terrorism is a little bit more difficult, at least in my understanding, because there really is no middle ground. When God is on your side, the other side is godless. And so right away, any kind of compromise is mooted because you're compromising with the devil. With secular groups, you know, there might be, you know, you can take a piece of territory and divide it. But when it's about religion, it's a lot more difficult. What we have seen is sometimes the various theological strains that undergird terrorism shift the ideology. So they can shift the ideology from refusing to allow women to allowing women. They can shift the ideology from saying no, children shouldn't be involved, to saying yes, we should use children as well as bombers. Or maybe they can even shift the ideology in the future to saying, well, you know what, we have the near and the far jihad, and maybe we can have a hudna, which is a temporary ceasefire or a truce. So it does, there is some wiggle room, but it seems that there's less wiggle room with religious terrorism than with the secular group.
If you're just joining us, today's program is from our Take Note archives. We talked with Professor Mia Bloom in June of 2012 when she was on the faculty of Penn State. She's currently a professor of security studies at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. Bloom is a leading expert on suicide terrorism and a frequent consultant to the military, policymakers, and the media.
You mentioned children just a moment ago. In the 1980s, the Ayatollah Khomeini engaged tens of thousands of children in a human wave against Iran. And I'm wondering, just how did the populace feel about using children in their war?
So the Ayatollah Khomeini was really capable of taking the current or the war that they were having in the 80s with Iraq and drawing on people's religious identification with the martyrdom of Hussein, which was the grandson of the Prophet and Ali's son. And so in the Shia faith, which is different than the Sunni interpretation of Islam, in the Shia faith, there is this edification of martyrdom. Every year on Ashura, they replay these acts of martyrdom that the Imam Hussein had to deal with and fighting. And so there is this notion that even children participate. You'll have people going to the mosque and they'll self-flagellate until they're completely bloody. They'll be wearing white clothing and they're not done until the white clothing is red. And they'll even bleed children slightly. So the idea of martyrdom is something ingrained in the Shia faith to such an extent that I think that Khomeini was able to translate that into encouraging people to participate in martyrdom against Iraq. Interestingly enough, however, when we look at Iraq now, the Shia groups are not using suicide terrorism, and it's only the Sunni groups. So that, again, is one of those theological shifts that I've talked about. With the human waves, there wasn't resistance. There was this perception that this was a religious holy war, that the Sunni were going to do to the current Iran what had been done in 688, you know, so going, hearkening back to this historical period. It's, again, interesting how he was able to manipulate complete dedication from Iranians. Till this day, there's pictures and paintings of Khomeini everywhere, as well as some of the young people who became martyrs. They're very well known as young as 15 years old, and their images were on lunchboxes and backpacks and T-shirts.
Heroes.
And so a whole generation of kids have grown up thinking, well, you know what, this is an appropriate thing for children to do.
And in fact, children are being raised, some children in Islamist schools, they're being trained to become suicide bombers, told that if they push the plunger, they'll be showered with flowers, for example.
So we've seen instances in Palestinian Media Watch, which is an Israeli-sponsored watchdog group in this country, has monitored a lot of Palestinian and Hamas TV, and they have a suicide-bombing Mickey Mouse, and they have a what looks like an Easter Bunny or Fozzie Bear that are instructing children from a very young age that what they want to do is they want to be suicide bombers. You'll have five-year-old, really cute little girls on television saying, you know, this is their goal. So these are these cultures of martyrdom that are being fostered in certain places. At the same time, in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, we have children being forced or coerced into becoming bombers. And so we have a whole range from what may appear a training from a very young age to grow up to be bombers to coercing children as young as 6 and 7 to be bombers, but they don't even know what they're doing at that moment.
And of course, the jihadists know that for American troops and allied troops, it's difficult to kill a woman or a child, even when you know this is a suicide bomber.
The interviews that I conducted for the book included some military personnel who had come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they told me stories of they would find kids planting IEDs, knowing these kids were involved, and, you know, the orders whether or not to shoot a child militant were very unclear, and it was a case by case. And so they tended to err on the side of caution and not shoot. But there were instances at checkpoints where they shot at cars that they thought were racing through checkpoints, ended up killing kids, and there was hell to pay. So the fact is that we don't have a clear and consistent set of procedures. How do you deal with children? Because the military still can't wrap its brain around the fact that the children are being activated at a very young age. We've seen this in Africa with child soldiers. And it's one of the things that has a huge psychological impact because many of the soldiers go to Iraq and Afghanistan, they have kids of their own. And it's really difficult for them to shoot kids. And again, the terrorist groups know this, and that's why they use children.
You've also said that women are such stealth weapons, number one, because they can go in places that men can't. They can feign pregnancy, for example, when in fact they don't have a baby, they're hiding a bomb. How do you counteract this? How does the U.S. government deal with this, this new reality in terrorism?
One of the things that we saw in Iraq was the United States government supported the Daughters of Iraq, which was women at checkpoints searching other women. Because, of course, in these very conservative societies, patting a woman down at a checkpoint was considered to be very invasive and could actually outrage the population. So if you didn't check women invasively, they were the ideal stealth weapon. And if you did check them, you were really going to alienate yourself from the population. You wanted the populations to support you and to separate the population, you know, from the insurgents. So the Israelis have done this. The Turks have done this. We have the Daughters of Iraq using more women. And this is, again, one of the reasons why having a mixed military has been helpful, because women military officers of the United States Army and the Marines can go in and talk to women, get information, they can man the checkpoints, and they eventually moved from manning the checkpoints to allowing Iraqi members of the security services who were women to man the checkpoints. So that's been one of the stopgap measures. I think the most important thing, though, is to convey to women in these societies, if you want to do something for your people, stay alive. Do it in different ways. Don't think that the only contribution you can make is with your death.
You say that women are motivated or coerced very often to become suicide bombers by the four R's. Briefly tell us what those are. And actually, there's a fifth R, which is rape.
Right. So what happens is the best predictor of a woman's involvement in terrorism, when we look across the board, has been relationship to a male who's in the terrorist group. All the women who I interviewed in Northern Ireland who had been members of the Provisional IRA, their brothers, their fathers, their uncles, their grandfathers had been members of either the Provisional IRA or its predecessors, the IRA. And they grew up sort of with this understanding that it was expected that they participate. It became almost family business. This is true also of some of the female Chechen bombers and even female bombers in Iraq. So this connection, this relationship, the R of relationship, is very important, because what it does is it's a vetting condition, right? Most terrorist groups are worried about being infiltrated. If you get the family members of a well-known individual in your group already, they can be vouched for. So that's one of the best predictors that when, you know, we see if a male bomber blows up somewhere, the first thing security services do is they look at their female family members. The other thing is this notion of respect. The women in some of the conflicts, actually, it's the women who have spearheaded the request to become involved, more involved in terrorism. So to go from behind the scenes to being on the front lines. One of the things I traced in my first book, Dying to Kill, was the Palestinian religious authorities for Hamas, Sheikhs Rantisi and Yassin, originally said, we don't need women. We have more than enough male bombers. And in fact, they would make fun of other groups that used women to say, oh, you're hiding behind your women. And it was the women of Hamas who constantly wrote to Yassin and to Rantisi and said, you know, we want to show that we're just as dedicated as the men in our lives. And that really was persuasive, in addition to the fact that once men were no longer able to get through checkpoints in Israel, they started using women. So they're very adaptive to this, but we start to see all these different reasons why women get involved, but there's no one overarching.
As we become more accustomed to who the enemy may be, you say your prediction is there will be more children.
In as much as there is a desire for a profile, a racial or some biometric profile of a suicide bomber that the military and the government can figure out, okay, we'll create a sensor for this, there really is no one profile. The moment we have a profile, like the one you described, male between the ages of 18 and 30, maybe with a beard because they're religious, the moment we have a profile, all the groups have to do is use someone that doesn't fit the profile. And it's the way that they adapt. One of the projects that the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State is doing is looking at how do the terrorist groups adapt and how do they adapt to counter-terrorist policies and figure out new ways and new ideas and new strategies to fall under that radar screen. So women was one of the things that they've done, older people, and increasingly now we're seeing more and more children, which is now the project that I'm working on, to try to figure out how do we interrupt. It's a form of child abuse where people are training children to do nothing but die. And so we need to figure out how do we counter the narrative that makes us attractive for children.
I'm just curious about how effective suicide bombers are. Of course, the first known suicide bombers were the kamikaze pilots during World War II. But it cost 2,500 trained, educated pilots to kill 5,000 Allied troops. Doesn't seem quite worth it.
Well, and this is where we start getting into these fine distinctions. Some people would consider the kamikazes less suicide bombers because it was a declared state of war. And it's the same way that when bin Laden talks about the firebombing of Dresden or the carpet bombings that the British and the American Air Forces engaged in World War II as a kind of, you know, terrorism. You know, that's where we sort of have to say, well, it's not exactly the same thing. We do look at the kamikazes because there was this notion of dying for the greater cause. In their case, the Shimpu warriors, the Divine Wind warriors, were dying for the emperor. And that's where we can link it to the suicide bombers. I think the idea is that a person who commits an atrocity, goes into a room with an AK-47 and shoots it up and leaves, clearly is a murderer. But a person who blows up the room with them, you know, they're still there, that's something different. That's, you know, that's an act, a demonstration of their dedication to a cause.
Effective, though? I mean, I guess it's one person loses her life and they can kill as many. Typical might be 40 people are killed and 160 are wounded, for example.
It's a really good question because it depends on what you're considering to be effective. A colleague of mine in Chicago, Robert Pape's argument is if you end occupation, you end suicide terrorism. None of the suicide terrorism other than the one instance in Lebanon has actually led to the end of an occupation. So if that's the end goal, independence of a state, the end of the presence of foreign military advisors or personnel, then it's not very effective. But if part of it is publicity, then it's very effective because suicide bombing tends to get 8 times more publicity than a regular bombing.
Especially if it's a pretty woman.
And especially if it's a woman, even more so. So the example I give my students is in March 2010, there were 2 female Chechen bombers in the Moscow subway. Later that week, there were 3 more attacks. Everybody knows about the March 2010 subway attacks. People don't realize that there were 3 more attacks in Dagestan.
The first two were women.
The first two were, yeah.
And one was a very young woman, a 17-year-old.
Yes, Jeanette Abdurakhmanova was very young. She was married to a well-known jihadi. He was killed. And a lot of people then, looking at my 4 hours plus 1, said, it was an act of revenge. And they found a photo of her sitting on his lap, veiled, holding a gun. And I thought, well, he's still alive in that photo. So it's more than just revenge that got her involved in militancy.
A Tel Aviv University psychologist is often quoted, and you write this in your book, as saying that the terrorism researcher has the obligation to make terrorism known. Ultimately, what do you hope your work, you're now working on your third book, which will be on gendercide and the strategic logic of using rape in war, what ultimately do you hope to accomplish?
Part of it has to do with countering the narratives that make terrorism attractive to a population, whether it's the men, the women, or the children. Making sure people know what's going on is very helpful. So, for instance, when Al-Qaeda on the internet says to American Muslims, you need to come and join the jihad in Iraq and Afghanistan because your sister's in Islam, the Muslim women in Iraq are being raped, what I hope to do is to say, well, they're the ones raping them. I think it's important to identify what the narratives are. Why do they resonate? Why do people say, oh, yes, you know, becoming a suicide bomber is great. So instead of people having posters of Michael Jordan on their wall, they have posters of well-known suicide bombers. We need to make it less glamorous. And the way that you do that is you let people know what really is involved in terrorism. The research that's been done at Penn State University has shown that the reason people leave is there's a disconnect between what they expected life to be and what it really was. We need to publicize that, and we need to make that known.
All right. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was a 2012 interview with Mia Bloom, then an associate professor in international and women's studies and a fellow at the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State. She's now a professor of security studies at the University of Massachusetts, Lal. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take notes. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.